Part 5. Which gets me to the final point I want to make about all of this. How that slipperiness of language takes on a more sinister aspect in a cultural moment like ours, already off the rails, not just in relation to conspiracy theories or cults, which use language to alienate followers from any reality that resides outside of language, but in the political arena and the news media. Right, left, no matter. It is all a sort of Orwellian trance that keeps us riveted on whatever the daily drama happens to be, agitated and disempowered all at once, waiting for the news cycle to click over to tomorrow. Hopeful it will be less horrifying, though it never is or can be, given the obsessive need for both politicians and the media to keep our attention riveted on this reiterating car crash on the other side of the freeway ad infinitum, until we lose control ourselves. Look for the next exit ramp to Rabbit Hole City, where we can pick one to duck into. About 2 weeks ago, three college presidents from among the most elite universities in America, Penn, Harvard, and MIT, testified before Congress with what are now notorious, even disastrous consequences. Two have since resigned. The other is hanging on precariously. How could such a thing happen? Well, there is no way for me to explain it outside the parameters of this matter of conspiracy theories and cults. On one side, the antagonistic one was the primary congressional questioner, Elise Stefanik. The formerly moderate congresswoman from New York, rebranded as MAGA during and after Trump's presidency. She was clearly primed for a stereotypical far-right knee-capping moment, asking each president in sequence, does calling for the genocide of Jews violate your college's rules or code of conduct on bullying and harassment? A simple question that each president answered tentatively and seemingly evasively. All Stefanik wanted or would accept was a yes or no answer, and it would seem then, on balance, that the most appropriate answer would be simply yes, as a form of dangerous or threatening hate speech, for example. Case closed. My question is not why Stefanik, who clearly cares not at all about the horrific annihilation going on now in Gaza, whose people, most likely under the dehumanizing rubric of terrorists in her mind, are not worthy of inclusion under the terms of her question, behaved as she did. She is simply playing to her type, a rapid right-wing politician, more interested in scoring points with her base and getting publicity than solving problems. If that seems too extreme a judgment, I direct your attention to the number of problems, aside from self-induced internal infighting matters, that have been solved over the last 2 years by the Republican majority in the House of Representatives, in which she holds a leadership position. The correct answer is none. My question is why these very highly educated and intelligent young leaders were not prepared for this kind of a bushwhacking, or why, in the moment, they weren't clever enough to see that just saying yes was the only way out of an otherwise unavoidable abyss of cultural lunacy. Some have suggested that they may have spent too much of their prep time with university lawyers, borrowing their discourse for their talking points. I think it's more complicated than that. I have to go back a ways, to the 1970s, to get on the runway toward my answer. I started graduate school in the early 70s. All of my preparation, or if you prefer an insider term, formation, as a critical reader beforehand, from grade school through college, was under the terms of the modernist agenda, which fetishized text-based reading practices, a very specific kind of close reading that expressly, by definition, must set aside the autobiographical predilections of author and reader. At that historical moment, a dramatic sea change was taking place in relation to critical ideology in the culture at large. Emergent was what would very shortly come to be called postmodernism, most broadly, or even more specifically, gesturing to its roots in French philosophy and theory, post-structuralism and deconstructionism, all of which shift the balance to the reader side of the interpretive equation. Those monikers are widely recognized now, if not very well understood, at the level of practice. They were not for me and my generation in the early 70s, when Michel Foucault's work first entered the American Academy via translation, and shortly thereafter, Jacques Derrida's. I realized very quickly that I was not well prepared via my deeply ensconced critical habits to succeed in this new marketplace of ideas, that I would need what was called back then a retooling, big time, as in recognizing how and why everything that had been taken for granted about literary critical reading practices for two generations, ever since the rise of the New Criticism, a weirdly indigenous American expression of the text-valorizing approaches that evolved first among post-World War I British scholars and poets, at least some of whom, like Ezra Pound, T.S. Eliot, and Hilda Doolittle, were American expatriates, was now outmoded. All of a sudden, this array of now new approaches, radically reader-centered, anathema to the New Criticism, were all the rage. The old order collapsed suddenly and completely, as old orders always do, when mutually irreconcilable systems collide at volatile historical moments, the new vanquishing the old. And no moment in my lifetime was more volatile than that one. The established order coming apart at the seams in America's streets, race, gender, sexual identity, and class being renegotiated down to the ground. Changing our preferred ways of reading was significant, but hardly the most urgent concern at that moment. Like the rest of my cohort, seeking to professionalize ourselves in durable ways, I set about retooling myself with a vengeance. I had an easier time than most, I suppose, because I already believed that the extant critical ideology was backward and bankrupt, unsuited to my instinctive preferences. So I was happy to welcome an alternative powerful enough to demolish it, even as I found it comparably self-aggrandizing in its ambitions, similarly unsuited to my preferences. The fact of the matter, I knew, was that if I wanted a career in my field, I would have to become adept with these new instruments. The most salutary side effect of this transition, the new one now in place, the old one still there, as all first systems are, though under erasure, was my immediate recognition that all critical systems, and therefore all ideological systems, were historically contingent, intrinsically local, relatively short-lived, a couple of generations in this case, and quite arbitrary. The winners among the several contestants during those relatively short windows of cultural collapse, like the 1920s when modernism took command, and the 1970s when postmodernism replaced it, were foundational change not only becomes possible, but inevitable. The internal mechanics of this are quite simple. When one's deeply held belief system falls apart and must be replaced, one understands down to the bones the fundamental duplicity of ideology, the way a divorce or getting fired alters one's sense of the inviolability of established cultural contracts forever. They are no longer eternal verities, which is how they announce themselves, but paper tigers, really, there and gone, once the next match is lit. During their second generations, though, when no alternatives are being proffered, they feel, in those interims, very much like the cults I am trying to write about here, ardently supported to the preclusion of alternatives. Until something comes along to wake everyone up again, something that will thereafter be recognized by those in the throes of change as another cult, perhaps a preferable one, and that once fully ensconced, it too will not be recognized as such by anyone. just the way things are, should be, and have always been. The next and new alternative in my critical reading scenario was, in that regard, I knew, exactly the same as the one it was working to replace. It would be there for a while, and then be dismantled by the next powerful alternative, already slouching towards Bethlehem to be born, as Yeats says in The Second Coming. Oddly, given my anti-authoritarian bent and addiction to change, both of which are temperamental, instead of vesting myself deeply in what was being proffered, I was already eagerly awaiting its demise. Couldn't wait for it, really. Even as I understood, I would have to become proficient with this now dominant currency of the moment. And I did do that, quite successfully. In other words, I could use it, but I could also see its future fatal flaws. A problem, though, arises for those indoctrinated during the second generation of such a movement. Their formations, from grade school on, have been univocal in critical terms, as mine were in the 50s and 60s. This now fully established orthodoxy is singular, unitary, without competition, so it will be received unquestioningly. There is simply no competitor on the scene, or even on the horizon, to challenge it. All of the college presidents testifying before Congress last week were formed in this second generation of the postmodernist era, and their answers were couched in that discourse, one immediately legible to an insider, but sounding ludicrous to someone operating in the framework of an entirely different cult, like MAGA politics. This is not to say that right-wing politicians are entirely ignorant of the critical systems that regulate life in the American Academy. Their weaponization of the discourse of those systems, stigmatizing woke, for example, which arose initially as an honorific term, is evidence of that. They simply operate from a different one. It may not be very sophisticated in philosophical terms. They haven't read any of the foundational material that generated the system or its discourses. But it is quite powerful in ideological terms, which is why we now call these skirmishes culture wars. The moments in the congressional hearing that were career-altering for these three college presidents occurred in exactly this sort of cauldron. And I believe they were unprepared for them, precisely because they could not yet fully imagine that a frontal challenge of this simple sort could gain such purchase. One can blame arrogance for that, of course, but I blame generational luck, bad or good, depending on your perspective. Having experienced the destabilization of my inner compass as I did 50 years ago, I would not just be prepared for, I would fully anticipate exactly the sort of sandbagging moments Stefanik created. I would have responded to it simply by answering, yes, it is a form of hate speech that is threatening and dangerous, which might at least temper, perhaps even diffuse, the explosive argument that question was designed to set off. Or as a friend so brilliantly suggested yesterday, I might ask Stefanik whether she would include Muslims in her categorical question about genocide, thereby destabilizing her position. This highlights one of the other effects of the postmodernist emphasis on discourse and the relativism of readerly responses it promoted. If the only realities are discursive, language can easily be dissociated from the truths that came before it. The experience and observations that produce verifiable facts, evidence, etc., are after it, action, and the presumption that one will live up to one's word. I've railed against this unintended side effect repeatedly. It actually created the conditions for the current fetishes for alternate facts, gaslighting, witch-hunting, fake news, and outright lies that we basically take for granted as foundational to our public discourse. Those things would be, and were, considered intolerable offenses in the context of modernist systems, which is why Richard Nixon was forced to resign for much less egregious offenses than Donald Trump, who may well be reelected. In fact, I believe there would be no MAGA movement right now were it not for postmodernist critical ideologies which laid the foundation for these ongoing sacrifices of truth to power. Their versions are, of course, bastardized, mis- or non-readings of the originals. But so few outside the academy have read the originals that they can't be challenged in a way that even makes sense to them. Those who have read them must find new ways, now more than ever, to fight back. In this case, for example, before, not after the forced resignations, while there is still a recognized position of authority to speak from, as these three might have, both individually and collectively, once they realized their fates were sealed, by calling out the tacit misogyny, why only female presidents, and racism, one of whom is black, that were baked into the hearing. Even alluding to those among Stefanik's posse who deploy anti-Semitic, Islamophobic, and even genocide-endorsing discourse, some expressly, more often of the dog whistle variety, including Stefanik's chief handler, Donald Trump. And then later, at the institutional level, by standing ground in the face of such bear-baiting tactics. And it would be a good opportunity to call attention to the denotative difference between characterizing one of these apparently correlative modes of hate speech as anti, that is, oppositional, and the other as phobic, that is, fear-based, a slipperiness of language with significant implications and consequences. These are not moments for knuckling under to bullies. They are the have you no sense of decency moments that finally brought Joe McCarthy's equally self-aggrandizing campaign against good people back in the 1950s to a screeching halt. That none of these presidents, nor the universities they served, were able to do this says something about the dire state of the idea of the university in the American culture. Again, I had to ask myself, how could something like this happen? And once again, I have to go back a ways to get on the runway toward an answer. I worked in a wide range of university cultures for almost 50 years, starting in the early 70s, when innovative new programs and institutions began to pop up and prosper. State support for public education was impactful, and a teaching nourished vision of what higher education could do and was for flourished. All fruits of the radical reform that spread across the wider society in the late 60s. Within a decade, the historically conservative nature of the American university as a cultural institution reasserted itself and gradually clawed back the status-related powers it had lost in this moment of creative vibrancy. By the mid-1990s, the battle was over. A top-down corporate model, having reshaped higher education in fundamental ways, especially in R1 universities, which, not coincidentally, ushered in the era of bank-financed student debt that now burdens so many of our graduates. Where I worked, the administrative cadre expanded dramatically as the teaching cadre contracted, more and more tenure stream positions transitioning to part-time and adjunct lines. The authority that faculty once shared collaboratively in governance matters was significantly diminished, and power was translated to the upper echelons, as it is in all organized capitalist institutions, religious, political, or corporate. At the same time, the teaching research binary became more and more skewed toward the latter. Often, with the enthusiastic support of the most elite faculty who promoted a book fetishistic approach to publication and demeaned teaching as a praise or raiseworthy credential. It is time now to begin to reverse that dysfunctional trend, to recover some idea of the good in our idea of the university, where the primal matrix should not be in the boardroom, but in the classroom. Period. I don't think right-wing politicians and pundits have any idea how much they owe to the elite academic culture they take such pleasure in skewering. Without the latter, none of the former would have their ground to stand on. Or, more accurately, they would have to find some real ground to stand on, where one's words were still connected to meanings and consequences. It's not that one is a cult and one isn't. They both are. As is every other ideological system that seizes the public imagination and exiles all competitors via whatever is the currently acceptable mechanism for enforcing heresies to aggregate power. The academic culture does this quite as well as the popular culture does. It just sounds a lot fancier as it goes about it. The proper response is not another cult, but actual thinking. I've tried, along the way here, not to delimit too much what actual thinking might look like, which will be different for everyone. One of the wonderful truths about personal agency, as long as you keep it, you retain the authority to define what it means, both for what you say and what you intend to do with what you say. There are many different ways to characterize what words mean. In the current political and social media arenas, there is a tendency, as I say above, toward dismissing even the most egregious verbal affronts as just language, therefore inconsequential. Lindsey Graham did exactly that yesterday, in exactly those terms, as he poo-pooed the idea that Donald Trump's reference to immigrants poisoning the blood of our country, a direct draw from Adolf Hitler's hit list, was offensive. His advice was not to listen to the words, but to get it right, which in this case could mean many things, all of them bad. This disregard for the importance of one's words is so chronic, we hardly blink at such an outlandish excuse for them. The antidote is one I've noted repeatedly over the years, behaving routinely as if our words are promissory, encapsulated in the everyday phrase I prefer, keeping one's word. This phrase elevates the concept of word from an externally inherited ideological gesture to an internally generated ethical imperative, one that presumes the connection I mentioned earlier between experience and wisdom, with language not as the end, but the means to get from one to the other, a way of thinking that has become so dissociated from public discourse as a precondition that someone like Lindsey Graham actually sounds reasonable to many, while he downplays this frightening fascist trope. I've tried in this essay to enact a way of reading that breaks through the invisible walls that tend to separate via literal covers one book from another. A de-siloed way of reading, in other words, to use another word from systems discourse. One that seeks to find common ground rather than to highlight difference. On a small scale, this promotes a broadly metaphoric habit of thinking that looks for connections where none were necessarily intended, as in the case of my five books, or where they were intentionally obfuscated, as in the case of Lindsey Graham's comment. Siloed reading has many benefits, of course, and I don't mean to dismiss them. But in a cultural moment, like ours, that fosters cultish thinking, in relatively innocuous ways sometimes, from the self-help industry, which promotes competition among approaches, often leading readers on an endless, unhelpful merry-go-round ride from one to another, to the more insidious forms of dogmatic ideology that have instigated on the political side, the slow-motion civil war we are now enduring in our country, or, on the religious side, anything from random acts of terroristic violence to outright genocide, all in the name of spiritual movements designed to promote peace. Developing this habit of mind, this way of thinking, is especially crucial for our own personal sanity at least, and perhaps for creating communities capable of functioning collaboratively. More broadly, I believe it can help to restore some semblance of integrity between language and meaning, which, for me, arises inevitably when I say what I mean with care, and mean what I say with care. Which sounds like a cartoon version of Dr. Seuss's elephant, I know. But that cartoon is way smarter in every respect than whatever one was playing in Lindsey Graham's head when he opened his mouth to speak yesterday. Something utterly unpredictable became visible to me when these five books coalesced into one, simply by reading them at a systems level. What my dream told me to call quantum reading. From that vantage point, each of these authors' problem-solution paradigms becomes one potentially legitimate alternative among many, instead of the only viable one. And I can enjoy a condition of intellectual liminality that makes it impossible to devote myself utterly to any singular ism, a frame of mind that then makes all of the available isms visible as alternative options, that insists on personal agency and not externally imposed orthodoxy as the only real guide toward crafting a preferred position, which is not precluded by that multiplicity, but actually becomes possible because of it. That is its beauty, not its deficit. That is the beauty, not the deficit of liminality. That is the beauty, not the deficit of mystery. While there may be nothing that is ever the absolute truth, there are many, many things that are absolutely stupid. Culling those off makes it possible to approach along a tangent some potentially true things. Avoiding concessions to the stupid may seem like a Pyrrhic victory when what you want is a story, a narrative line, some consecutive reasoning that removes all ambiguity, that answers all questions. But it is way better than running scared down the nearest rabbit hole from which there will be no exit. This is the final stanza from John Keats' famous bit of reading in the British Museum, his Ode on a Grecian Urn. Oh, Attic shape, fair attitude, with breed of marble men and maidens overwrought, with forest branches and the trodden weed. Thou, silent form, dost tease us out of thought, as doth eternity. Cold pastoral, when old age shall this generation waste, thou shalt remain in midst of other woe than ours, a friend to man, to whom thou sayest, beauty is truth, truth beauty. That is all ye know on earth, and all ye need to know. Thinking, which is always moving, as doth eternity, teases us out of thought, which is fixed, like the marble men and maidens overwrought in both senses of that word. When our generation has passed, with all of its preferred explanations for how and why we ended up in such a mess, there will be another and another in midst of other woe, each seeking their own explanations, truth and beauty, paired here, like many comparable other such pairs, in perfect quantum balance in Keats's imagination, his ultimate mystery. I like it, as I do many comparable others. But even at my age, I haven't yet settled on the one I want to finalize, which is where I began and where I want to end, in a quantum ambivalence that captures the enigma of life in this universe. Always. Afterword. The original title of this piece, Off the Rails, was, as I said at the outset, not quite right for what I was trying to get at here. implying that there is a set of right rails that keeps us on track, and that going off them is the problem. It's much more complicated than that. So I'm going to return to that metaphor briefly here to make one final point. In fact, I would say the set of conventional rails we inherit thoughtlessly simply by being born in a specific place and time, while it may be comfortable, will never lead to actual thinking. Nor is going off them the solution. There are always rails. The only question is whether we will lay our own or rely on others, whether respected authorities to help us with the work or on scrupulous con artists to do it for us. Finding a set of rails that suits one's personal values and temperament does, yes, require getting off the rails inherited from family, church, school, workplace, nation, etc., the standard tropes that cultural systems use as modes of indoctrination, at least for a while. That's why many Catholics, even devout ones, spend some time in a lapsed phase along the way. Once one is off those rails, the work of a lifetime can begin. What I have generically named as actual thinking, which requires all of those things I mentioned. Work, research, fact-checking, new knowledge formation, time, and reading. At some point, going back to one's original rails is a legitimate option, of course, sometimes a good one. See Descartes, for example. As is cobbling together a completely unique one, my own preference. During that interim, while one is off one set of rails and hasn't quite found or laid down another, as I was in graduate school back in the 70s, a chronic state of irresolution is inevitable. I happen to like such states, as most poets do. For others, they incite the intolerable anxiety Naomi Klein indexes, and looking for a quick exit, the rabbit hole becomes pressing. Resisting that anxiety long enough to make a considered choice is important to avoid being victimized by a set of externally imposed rails that is even worse, another array of equally off-the-shelf cultural tropes, for example. Or, worst of all, one of those conspiracy theories and cults I allude to generally here. I was lucky to learn very early on not just to tolerate, but to enjoy irresolution, to experience it as generative, creative, which, over time, allowed me to access the systems level I talk about, from which I could view all the lower levels of rails I left behind or encountered along the way with equanimity, searching for what they share in common, as in the case of my stacked reading experience this month. Celis Glendinning, the Gnostic Gospelists, Mikhail Bakunin, and Li Bai, especially late in his life, once he found his preferred heaven, are afflicted by the same concerns you and I are. Things are not right. And none of them is necessarily wrong about how or why we ended up in such a mess, nor is any solution they proffer necessarily preferable. There are hundreds, thousands of other complainants scattered across history with similar tales of woe. None of them is necessarily wrong. Human civilization went off the rails forever ago, which is why we have imagined so many different Edenic paradises from which we have fallen. And it did again today, while we weren't yet looking. No matter. We need to learn to think, to find any path forward from these otherwise dead-end moments. Reading provocative, well-written books, whether 5 or 5,000, trying to decipher some true things they might share in common, is among the ways we are still fortunate to have for doing that, despite the many book burnings, buryings, and bannings our civilization has endured. Truth and beauty pulsing in quantum superposition across human history, then and now, there and here, separate and the same, one as many, many into one, waiting patiently for us to find our own personal moments of synchronicity. That may not be all we know on Earth or all we need to know, but it's the best way I know of to exercise my own personal agency and, if I'm lucky, maybe to learn some new ways to fight back. I highly recommend it.